Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Our panellists this morning, Alison O'Connor is a columnist for the Sunday Times. Scott Lucas is Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Simon Lewis is the principal of Carlo Educate Together National School and a podcaster. And Lorraine Sweeney is a businesswoman and hotelier. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Alison, the front of the Sunday Times, Stephen Donnelly coming out very strongly here on banning social media for children.
Yes, Brendan. And I suppose looking at it with my sort of political hat on, it's interesting to see Stephen Donnelly coming out on this. You see he's done a lot of work on other things like women's health, which I admired from a couple of other issues. But I think Stephen Donnelly has been clever in that this government is coming to an end. He has not had that much success in relation to reforming the health system. And in fairness to him, you do need the support of your government partners for that and your fellow ministers. So he's going for other, maybe I was going to say more low hanging fruit, but clearly an effort to ban social media for under 16s, you wouldn't class that.
Ambitious is the top of the tree, exactly.
Yeah. Now, as a parent, I would look at that and looked at it earlier this morning and thought, bring it on. But realistically, you're thinking, how are you planning on doing this? The phrase horse and bolted certainly came to mind. And yet, I admire it. I think he's right to speak out.
Is it good? I'm wondering. The Minister for Health in this country is generally a minister for the HSE, right?
Yeah.
And that's what they talk about generally, right?
Yeah.
Whereas health is like, health of all kinds is an obsession with people in their day-to-day lives. Yeah. They do not associate the Minister for Health with that, though, generally. That's a different kind of health.
No, but I mean,
Is it good that they're doing this blue sky thinking, and thinking of things beyond the kind of latest atrocity in the HSE
He did another interview during the week where he made the very relevant point that if you invest the money in keeping people healthy, it's a lot cheaper than having to treat people when they're ill. And I think that this goes exactly to that point, that if you have young children particularly and teenagers obsessively on social media in an unfettered way, that has a really detrimental effect on their mental health. So I think even if you're a little bit sceptical about how is he going to do this, I think it's a good thing that it's been brought to the forefront. The Minister for Education, Norma Foley, spoke about a ban on phones in schools this week. I think all of that is helping to inform parents. It does filter down to the teens. But I do, what my concern is, what could the social media companies have become so incredibly powerful? I mean,
More powerful than government.
They're more powerful. But you even look at Elon Musk and Twitter and how Elon Musk is using Twitter for such nefarious reasons now, even interfering in the riots in the UK in recent times, how governments are allowing that to continue. But Stephen Donnelly is saying right now, he's saying to social media companies, your product is harming children and therefore the first thing we're going to do is to remove access for children. I don't know how Stephen Donnelly is going to come into everybody's home and do that. He's not going to. But I think that if there's that increasing awareness, and particularly at EU level, that's really where it's going to count, is whether something can be done. I think he's on to a good thing. It's how much can be done is the question.
Scott, you're looking quizzical. I'll come to you in a minute, but I want to go to Simon Lewis first as the principal of a primary school. So look, as much as parents are seeing the cold face of this, you're seeing it. We saw a lot of teachers during the week on Norma Foley and the phones ban seem to be saying, well, like, what's this about? We're doing this anyway and everything. But is any kind of leadership and support on this kind of thing from the government welcome?
I would say yes, it is. I think, you know, the cynics of us in education would say that it's a bit of a distraction from the issues that we are facing in education. And this is, as was said, is a low-hanging fruit. It's an easy win. It's a popular kind of thing, stance. But I think it's important that politicians, even if they don't have absolute control, putting that pressure on is probably a positive step. And I think what Norma Foley's done, to her credit, is bring the issue up. Schools have been banning mobile phones for years.
How does it tend to work? Does it work well in schools, in your experience?
It does, yeah. I mean, children aren't allowed to have mobile phones on in schools. If they have to bring a phone in for when they're on buses and things like that, the phone has to be at the bottom of their school bag off and it doesn't come out. And many schools, if they see the mobile phone out of the bag, it can be taken and handed back to parents, or parents have to collect them, these kind of things. I think at second level, there's all sorts of other ways that students, they have to, you know, give their phone and push it into a little box outside their locker and things like that. But the social media kind of thing, it's such a big issue, and I think it's taken over absolutely every aspect. I was glad to see, you know, another minister talking about it. I think, I suppose, the next stage really is, I mean, these Norma Foley, Stephen Donnelly, they brought it to the fore. The next step is, well, let's actually make it as vulgar as it is. I mean, it should be, to me, having a child with a mobile phone, looking at a mobile phone, should be as vulgar as seeing a child with a cigarette kind of thing at this stage.
Really?
Yeah, okay. I think it's that dangerous.
Up to what age?
I don't know what it is. I mean, but certainly older than it is
we'll
right
know,
now.
We'll know when we see it, yeah. Okay, Scott, you're having none of all this.
It reads to me, possibly as a pre-election story, as a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Now, I've got skin in the game here. I mean, I teach media and politics, and it's part of my day-to-day, basically discussions with young folks as well as others. Look, any form of media advancement brings its good sides and it brings its downsides. It's the tool, it's the person using the tool that you have to go to. I'm old enough to remember in ancient times, i.e. when I was a child, when television was called an idiot box.
Yeah.
I know with the advent of the internet in the 1990s that you had those who were cyber optimists, those who were cyber pessimists. The practical point of this is you're going to ban all social media for people under 16. You're going to ban TikTok. You're going to ban Insta and all of that. Good luck with that. Teenagers are shrewd enough to talk about workarounds around any type of ban. That's one practical issue to talk about.
But I think this is a negotiating position, Scott. I think that's never going to happen. But I think it raises awareness. And I think as a parent, certainly, I will take as much help as I can get to try and find a good and positive way to be a parent in this circumstance. So I think that rather than looking at it negatively and sort of an illiberal thing to do, if you like, I think it's a good starting point.
I think a proper negotiating position is not to go in and say ban. I think a proper negotiating position is to talk about, look, this is a space which does need to be regulated. It needs to be regulated for multiple issues. It needs to be regulated with respect to bullying. It needs to be respected in terms of women's rights.
But you're sort
rights.
Of throwing buns at elephants with these companies. They don't give a toss. So I think that's why you need to try and scare them into it.
I think the problem is that we have highly irresponsible actors like Elon Musk who are going to suck all the oxygen out of the room. But when you talk about social media companies, there's a lot of small social media companies. It's not just the TikToks and the X's that we talk about. And some of those folks will engage with you. They will be responsible in talking about it. Think about, for example, all the negotiations when we talked around data protection in an earlier phase of these discussions about a responsible internet. We were able to get there largely through the EU. So I agree with a lot of what you're saying here, but I think the tactic here by the government is one which may not be the most productive way forward, especially with young people who are going to feel like you're just coming down on us, you're punishing us for problems that lie elsewhere.
Lorraine, the kind of age profile of the young people in your house would be that presumably you kind of saw this developing over the last number
exactly.
of years. Yeah,
I've had a blended family, so I'm dealing with teenagers for an awful long time. I think it's a headline in today's paper that is not achievable. I think banning anything actually makes it more attractive. If you think about when they banned alcohol in America back in the days, it actually created a new subculture for alcohol. You know, when we're talking about secondary school students and you know, asking them not to have a phone at school or not to have access up to the age of 16 is totally and utterly unrealistic in this day and age, in my opinion. You also have to treat them like adults as well and give them a certain level of responsibility. I would say parents, in some schools, parents are working together. I believe in Greystones in County Wicklow, there's a ban in the primary schools of phones, and I think that's a positive step. I think there's a move forward for parents to become more active in it. It's not the school's problem and it's not the state's problem, it's the family's problem. And I think we have to see families working together with the schools in order to achieve a better goal. So I would say, Minister Donnelly, it is a headline for an election. And I think the phones, banning phones in schools by the minister is also, you know, a pipe dream. It's not going to happen, but we obviously all want to protect our children.
Just finally on that, is it a pipe dream, Simon, banning schools and banning phones in schools?
Not really. I mean, I think it's already happening, you know, banning school. I mean, just on some of the point there, I think the phone isn't actually the problem itself. I think to me, it's the content that comes to the young people that needs to be controlled within. I think it's within half an hour of a teenage boy accessing social media, they're presented with content that's deeply inappropriate, and similarly for girls. And I think that's where the issue may lie, that it's really the content. It's in some ways it's like the difference between an unloaded and a loaded gun. You know, you just, you know, yeah, okay. To me.
Okay, sticking with this area in general, Lorraine, you picked Conor Skehan's piece in the Sunday Independent today around the Leaving Cert and the Leaving Cert results, and we had the annual kind of ritualistic unveiling of the results and pictures in the paper, etc. Happiness isn't measured by CAO points or good college choices.
Well, that's very true. I had the opportunity to be travelling with 14 Leaving Cert students who got their results as we landed. We had hoped to be...
Where were you going? To Mallorca or Magaluf?
No,
we were
in Ethiopia, right. Where we're very closely aligned with the country of Ethiopia, and 14 young men. It was very interesting to travel with them, and they all got their Leaving Cert results as we landed, which was not the plan, but that's how it happened.
And can I ask, were they going out to do volunteer work or something?
They were going out to finish off their education. Okay. In terms of, you know, they've come to Leaving Cert and they've grown up in this lovely country, and they went out by their own choice, I might add. They skipped Electric Picnic to go to Ethiopia, which was a very interesting choice. Some of them had tickets, and when they got the opportunity, they sold their tickets. So
their parents sick with jealousy all over the country.
Many of them.
Why couldn't mine have wanted to go to Ethiopia?
They didn't get to come, but we did. I did have two mothers with me. You could see the anxiety in them leading up to the return and facing the Leaving Cert results. But they accepted what they saw. They saw the good, the bad, and they saw the terrible during the week. So what I would say is Leaving Cert is a huge day, obviously, for any student. I thought it read in one of the papers today in The Independent that generation moderation, that the actual celebrations have kind of calmed down a little bit. In another article in The Independent on page 25, yes, happiness isn't measured solely by the results or by the CAO. It's more about what happens next. It also said that it's a time when parents actually are finishing up their education or their mollycoddling, shall we call them, of their children, and the kids are on their own from here on in, largely. So,
are they, Alison? Are they really? Are they finished being mollycoddled at 18?
Well, I mean, I suppose, how do you change the habits of a lifetime? If the child is going to be staying with you until they're 38 because they can't get a house. I am as a parent facing into that this year, and for a long, long time, I have thought that the Leaving Cert is in so many ways an absolute load of nonsense, in that it's a national obsession. If you never had a child, had no interest in students or education, on a certain Wednesday in June, you would still know how the Leaving Cert higher English paper had gone. Because that's all we will talk about that week and all that will be reported upon. So how do you tell children then that it's not important? I mean, I don't, that we will put, that we have an education system that puts that sort of pressure on young people. The whole palaver with the CAO, I mean, I know it has to be organised in a certain way and that people get into college, but my God, do we need to rethink. And even some of the parents that I know, who are the sanest parents that I know, who've done a fabulous job of raising their children, have become nervous wrecks for the Leaving Cert year. And so much of that then is they're trying to hide their nerves from the children, but trying to keep the child on a very sort of a steady, you know, progress. It's all just kind of cracked, really. Somebody needs to call a halt to it in some manner.
There's too much emphasis on the student who gets the 600 plus or the 625. You know, if you look at the papers yesterday, what it had was the person who got 625 and 624.
Yeah, and look, well done to them.
Well done to them, and more power to them. But the average person has worked, once they've worked to their maximum potential, that's really what a parent should be wishing for, as opposed to achieving the highest in the school.
Okay, so Simon Lewis, as a professional educator, what's your view on it all? Like, everyone, half the people certainly seem to agree that this is an awful potato grading system. And like, Alison, clearly you feel you're facing into a year of stress for the whole family now over this.
Yeah, that there's something wrong with us if we don't.
Yeah.
That this is it. I think it's nearly become... It's almost like a sporting event, the Leaving Cert. Like, everyone's obsessed by it, and you've got like league tables, and you know that make no sense. There's no grounding in them, and all these people under a huge amount of pressure for a very small amount, you know, for this very very concentrated amount of time, and yet the education system building up to it in a way is teachers have evolved their teaching to try and teach despite this really horrible...
So you're trying to educate despite the system.
Educate despite the system. And in some ways, the Leaving Cert itself is based on reasonably good foundation, but its European equivalents have sort of matured and evolved to be a little bit more rounded and progressive and maybe more of a focus on making well-rounded, educated people rather than this race to get as many points as you can to get into a, you know, to be in a competition.
Are you teaching kids at all to be, how to cope with life and how to maybe try and be happy? Is there any element of that in the system?
At primary level, for sure. I mean, it's what we spend half of our day doing, you know, and more so since I started teaching 20 years ago, there's a much more emphasis on, you know, life skills and happiness and empathy and teaching all the sort of soft skills, I suppose, they've been known. And secondary skills as well, I mean, have evolved since we were there. It's just that big elephant in the room. It's almost this rite of passage that we all believe, you know, we all went through it. But we all still wake up in a cold sweat in our mid-40s going, oh, my God, I didn't study enough. And it's just very strange.
Yeah. 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 And it's not the studying. It's the feeling that you should be studying all the time. It's the inability to kind of, for that year or two, to focus on anything else in your life. Scott, as a relative newcomer to Ireland, is this your first time seeing this annual kind of beano? Are you surprised by it?
I mean, I am a recent blow-in, having come here in March, but from the UK. But having raised two kids there, it's a similar story there with the A-levels, the equivalent to the Leaving Cert. And I fully agree with what's being said here, which is that this targeting of points, it causes a problem for parents, it causes it for students, it causes it for universities as well. Because what we wind up is we wind up getting people who are being judged by just this numerical metric rather than what type of people they are, what type of interests they have, et cetera.
So do you have the wrong students in courses in college? Do you encounter people who shouldn't be where they are? Do you encounter people who aren't?
I wouldn't say it's the wrong student, because the people who come there, they still have earned it. But what it does is you've got this mindset that you're sitting here trying to hit like target after target after target. And the whole process of education, as you all probably know, even in our days, was, you know, learning things that aren't necessarily part of a target. Certain things that are not necessarily part of your core curriculum that you think about and so on.
I remember well going into first year in college and these guys starting to try and educate us, and teach us how to think and everything.
Yeah.
And people getting really angry with them and go, is this coming up in the exam or what's the story here and everything? It was a complete clash of two cultures, like.
Well, we also have this obsession. I don't know, it'd be interesting to know, does Scott agree with this? We have this obsession with sending every single child to college. It's certainly middle class obsession, where then you have, and that everyone will agree that apprenticeships are a great thing, just not for my child. Do you know what I mean? I don't know whether you've noticed that, Scott.
Oh, it was absolutely with the UK. It was absolutely for a period where we had to have a numerical target of so many people had to go into universities, and we have the league tables. And you get the knock-on effect here, which is not just simply the fact that, look, university may not be the right route for someone. You get a knock-on effect which happened this week here, which is the story that I immediately ran into is great inflation. Great inflation. Now, we can make the argument coming out of COVID and beyond in terms of where everybody had to make adjustments, you know, about the examining boards and how they're examining.
Okay.
We can discuss that rationally. But imagine if your child was coming out with a result from a Leaving Cert, and if they had succeeded and read, great inflation. And it's like, well, wait a minute, didn't I earn this? Imagine if you had failed your Leaving Cert and you read, you failed despite the fact that grades were inflated.
Okay. And look, we could get stuck into the grade inflation, but there's lots of other things going on that I want to talk about. Lorraine, there's a piece in the Business Post. Please don't do it. UKIO owner's advice to anyone thinking about opening a restaurant.
Yeah. And really, that's very dear to my heart this morning. I read two articles, actually, in the Business Post and page 3 of the Times as well, about the VAT and the knock-on effect it's having. It's predicted that I experience it myself. I'm not in the fine dining, but I know
Me about Duncan McGuire first, the owner of this UKIO bar and his wife. So that business is there 14 years.
It's 2004, I think it's 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years.
And successful restaurant.
And his wife, Lou Leahy, I think it's a family business.
Family business, work hard, build it up over a long period of time. And the last few years have been just absolutely and utterly impossible. If you take the real trouble started at the pandemic, and then there was a lower VAT rate to help people pull through it. And that was reinstated last September against all better judgments, I might add. I'm not a representative of any restaurants association or anything like that, but I have every empathy when I read an article.
But you are in this business.
I'm in the hotel and catering business, and I'm in the cafe business as well. But I'm not in the fine dining restaurants, and this is where it's really hitting at its very hardest, is that, and it's interesting that there's two articles in both papers today, the Times and the Business Post, that really, over the next few years, 70% of our fine dining restaurants are going to close. This is what it's predicted in the newspapers today. And I can...
Maybe people don't want fine dining anymore.
Well, the pandemic did start a big practice of food delivery. And, you know, there's a lot of people getting food delivery now, which I think has affected the fine dining restaurants. But the big effect on fine dining restaurants is higher costs, higher VAT, higher labour costs. They've introduced sick pay, which next year we will have to pay 2 weeks' pay for people who are out sick. Now, one might say you should be able to afford it, but the fine dining and the catering businesses can't afford all these extra costs all at the one time. And that's what we're getting. We're getting costs piled onto us.
The lower VAT was not supposed to be a donation to the business's profits. It was supposed to enable them to
keep the second. We have the second highest VAT rate in Europe. And if you want to go to Denmark and pay €9 for a cup of coffee, they have the highest VAT rate. We have the second highest VAT rate on restaurants in Europe. And that's unsustainable. We all talk about the cheap food we get in Portugal and Spain and France. Their VAT rates are all scaled very much lower than us. But it's not only VAT. It's VAT. It's rents are high. Food costs have shot up. Labour costs have shot up. And it's really an impossible mission to run a quality restaurant in this city, and we need it for our tourism sector, and we're not going to have it into the future.
Yeah, so
it's a problem for the government,
and
they should really sit down with people. Like in times gone past, minimum wage increases were discussed around the table with industry representatives, and that didn't happen last year, and there's going to be another increase next year. This is the current government deciding they know better what to do, and the knock-on effect is very bad for the industry.
Okay. Now, there is a line in there from the figures from the company registration office. This year, 10 new restaurants or cafes were registered for each closure. So there were 629 new companies in this sector and 55 liquidations. So clearly some people still think there's money to be made there. Alison, you were looking at that as well.
Yeah, I was. And I mean, and this is a restaurant that I'd have gone to a number of times over the years. A very good restaurant. I'm sad to see that it's
closing.
Is it the
one with the karaoke rooms downstairs?
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I suppose it's been striking me for a while. I guess it's since the pandemic. Even I'm from West Cork, from Bantry, and being on holidays, I noticed the same this year. Various towns around that, the number of restaurants that have closed, the number of places you can go if you're there in a town on a Monday or Tuesday. So many places, they're all closed at that time. The number of times over the last couple of summers that tourists might have stopped and asked for advice, and you end up sending them to a chipper.
Yep.
Because there's nowhere for them to go for an evening meal. And yet, as a consumer, you're going into a restaurant. I mean, I've often thought that if we were still paying for babysitters, you just wouldn't be able to afford to go out for dinner. So there is that thing. As a consumer, you feel you're paying an absolute fortune. Restaurant owners are saying that they simply can't afford to go on. You then tie
no,
it
I
in
do
with,
think a lot of them down in West Cork and Kerry, yeah. What they'll tell you is they can't get staff as well.
Isn't
staff that a
major is
major issue?
Most,
so they're limiting
is,
their opening
staff
nights
is
and
most,
stuff.
So we were in a restaurant during the summer and the waitress said that somebody had called in sick. She was doing an extra shift. And if she hadn't been available, their entire patio area wouldn't have been open, and it was a nice yeah. summer's evening.
Can I jump you on to, yeah. there's a related piece there in the Sunday Independent by Mark Keane.
That's
Fair
exactly.
City. And
because,
this is
yeah.
the broader picture of
Duncan
Dublin
Maguire,
city
who owns Okio, is making the point that we'd say the riots in Dublin last year put the final nail in the coffin, and he's also saying that restaurants in suburbs that he's hearing anecdotally, they're doing better. So Mark Keane has a really good piece. It's a big spread, and this picks up on a lot of what was on, I think, a lot of Liveline this week. And you can say this as someone who lives in Dublin. The sense of menace in Dublin city centre, the sense of a city in decay, I have had friends say to me, if we're arranging to go out for a night, I'd rather not go. I don't feel this personally. I'd feel safe enough around Grafton Street or George Street, whatever, but saying,
so,
I don't feel...
Southside.
Southside, indeed. Southside. Yeah. Saying, I'd rather eat, I'd rather stick to the suburbs. And certainly, I think that it would be... parents very concerned about teenagers and that.
No, we are
being
old
in the city centre.
We are old yeah. too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Old people do stop going to town.
No,
the
that
young
is
crowd
true.
Do still
no,
seem
but you
to
feel,
go in there
but even
and everything.
If you, even
and
I,
yeah. there has always been a regeneration as well yeah. of new
but
types of places coming
yeah, but
in.
But there
and
is
stuff
no regeneration of. You walk along the quays, you walk along the Dublin city centre, and there is an air of decay. You walk along O'Connell Street, there is no sense of a city that has been cared for, of a vibrancy, of a sense of momentum. Of there being any urban renewal. This government most certainly can be accused of overseeing, admittedly there was the pandemic, gross neglect of Dublin city centre. And it doesn't look like there's any plan in the offing to do anything about that.
I think there are various plans and task forces. Scott, what do you think of Dublin city centre?
You know, I've got such a deep attachment to Dublin because, you know, I've been working on an ad hoc basis there since 2006, got to know it through colleagues, through people. And I think I'm going to use this to jump to the wider point in a second. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Dublin's going through this period of tension, which is in so many ways this very vibrant city, this city that others were looking to. And I come as someone who had lived in London, who lived in Birmingham. And now you've got a city which, in a sense, almost grew too fast. There's more money about. You've got a country with, what, 12% GDP growth in 2023, but the infrastructure hasn't kept up. The simple space isn't there. And I think this has caused knock-on problems we could talk about. But I was going to ask when I heard this story, is this a Dublin issue we're talking about with the restaurants
no.
or an Irish issue? Because just to give you the cases I'm seeing and put this into the mix for the discussion, I go to Greystones, right? It's absolutely buzzing right now. Mm-hmm. It's buzzing with new places that are there. There are obvious reasons why Greystones is attractive, why people are moving in there, et cetera, right? So that's a different dynamic for restaurants that are there. Wicklow Town, and I love my new home. God bless it. I love it. But there are almost no fine dining restaurants in Wicklow. There's actually a market there in Wicklow to be moved into, right? I'm not sure why the market isn't being moved into, if it's because of high cost, if it's because of labor issues or other issues. So I'm seeing sort of a patchwork mm-hmm. situation.
Patchy, right.
In and beyond Dublin.
Yeah, there's definitely, it does feel like, Lorraine, there has been a move to how people are, certainly people of as they get older, that they are now going to, and even when you say suburbs in Dublin, a lot of the suburbs are actually like small towns,
yes.
small villages,
yes.
and people are socialising that way.
Yes. Well, the cost thing, first of all, is nationwide and restaurants right throughout the country. The full employment is making a huge problem for the cost of running the business. And I think this is something that the government has to tackle for all businesses, actually, because all businesses are struggling to hire people. I'd just correct Alison on sending somebody to a chipper, because I do run a fish and chip shop. Mm-hmm. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with sending somebody to a fine fish and chip restaurant.
Couldn't agree with you
which
more.
Which I have. It's
the national dish at this stage, the fish and chips. Right, we'll have to leave that there because there's a lot more I want to get to, but we'll take a break. Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas, Simon Lewis and Lorraine Sweeney staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Expert advice on vitamins to help build immunity at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas, Simon Lewis and Lorraine Sweeney. Scott, you've been watching what's been going on overnight in the Middle East. So can you tell us what's happening and what does it mean in your opinion?
Yeah. So the immediate story is that Israel carried out a series of missile strikes on Hezbollah positions, what they call launchers. The Israeli story, and they say they hit thousands of these positions with 100 jets, was they were preempting a Hezbollah strike for 5 a.m. this morning. Now, Hezbollah has gone ahead and fired about 200 rockets and about 20 drones anyway across. So we have to see if we have an escalation
of
this
ongoing. Did Israel fire first?
Yeah, Israel did fire first.
They did for sure. But
calling it a preemptive strike.
Yeah, okay.
And then Hezbollah is going to say, no, you didn't knock us out. We can still hit you. So they fired back. We're still getting information, especially off the Israeli side, as to whether there's been significant casualties. It appears that it's not. Let me give an immediate context and then the big question ahead. The context for all of this goes back to late July. As part of this wider issue, which includes Israel's mass killings in Gaza, there have been skirmishes between Israel and Hezbollah, and Israel killed Hezbollah's number two, Fuad Shukr, at the end of July. The next day, they killed the Hamas political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, in Tehran. So, you know, they really crossed lines with those attacks. And both Iran and Hezbollah have been saying for weeks, we will get you, we will get you. And the question is, was this the moment that Hezbollah, backed by Iran, was it going to get Israel?
So the question here is this Iran-based?
Yes.
Is that significant here?
Well, Hezbollah always is not just a puppet of Iran. We have to emphasize this. They will have made their own calculations. They will have done it in discussion with Iran. Right now, Iran's media is playing it very cagey. They are saying Hezbollah has strike and Hezbollah could strike in the future, but I don't have the tip-off. We've got a wider Iranian strike. So two things to watch out for. If Iran fires drones and missiles, is it like in April where it was a demonstration strike? Because they told Israel's allies in advance. Secondly, and importantly for those Irish peacekeepers that are out there, is either Israel or Hezbollah going to launch ground operations across that border?
Should our peacekeeping forces still be there?
Yeah, I think you should. And look, it is at great risk to them. We know that an Israeli strike almost hit a few Irish peacekeepers a couple weeks ago. But if you withdraw the peacekeepers from that, you almost give the signal, which is we're putting up our hands and let the chips fall where they may. As long as you got the peacekeepers there, you still have this symbol, which is we want this de-escalated. We want everybody to pull back from confrontation.
Okay. Simon Lewis, as a person who is Jewish, how do you observe all this and your feelings towards it? What sense of connection you feel with what's going on there?
It's a question, I suppose. I've been asked. I was born here, but raised in a Jewish family, and it's only really since the latest situation that I'm feeling more nervous as someone with a Jewish ethnicity. But for me, it's because of what Israel has been doing in my ethnicity's name, and that's where I have great fears. That's where I get more scared in a way, and I bat off. I be fairly active online with discussions around education, but I find that a lot of my discussions are ending with sort of anti-Semitic tropes or, you know, why don't you go off and kill a few Palestinians, this kind of stuff. And I have, and that's not my stance in any way, shape or form. And it's quite a difficult place. And I don't speak for at all for Jewish people.
No, no, and I'm not asking person. You to, yeah, yeah.
But that would be my personal thing.
So were you kind of largely, did you think much about being Jewish before the last while? Like because you're not practicing or anything. So not a huge part of your life, really. But
I grew up in a very observant family, I mean, yeah, for sure. And I practiced until my teens, you know, and so on. And I went to a Jewish school. And I mean, Zionism would have been taught to me as fact and so on. And I mean, as I grew up and, you know, I moved away from the religion, but also, you know, questioned, you know, some of the stuff you'd be taught in school, as many people do. I mean, you know, that I'm sure many people here went to, you know, religious schools
in all religions,
and question that as they get older. So, I mean, as an adult, I suppose Judaism didn't really sort of enter my life a little bit. I mean, a small bit. I mean, I've written about it. I've published a few things on it, but in the course of my day-to-day life, no, and certainly not in the course of my discussions, where I'm, you know, speaking on, yeah, speaking about. But
yeah, it has now.
It has now. I'd say, yeah, at least once a fortnight, somebody will send me some, anti-Semitic trope of some sort, and that's just the way it is, you know. And it's not great, and it's sort of worse, nearly, in a way that something atrocious is happening in, I guess, my name. I mean, it's not my name, but you know what, mm-hmm, I mean when I say that. It's tricky.
Okay. Sorry if we put you on the spot.
Not at all. No, I'm very happy to talk about it.
Yeah, okay. So Scott, just before we leave that, so what's your kind of outlook on what happens next or where we could be at?
Yeah, my reading still is that neither Israel nor Hezbollah stroke Iran want a widening of this to a direct confrontation. From the standpoint of Hezbollah, the Lebanese economy is almost broken.
Yeah. People say, oh, Hezbollah are such a stronger fighting force than Hamas and everything. Hezbollah are not ready for or able for a war with Israel. Sure, they're not.
No, they're not in terms of a direct military conflict, because they'd be outgunned. And also, it could break Lebanon socially and economically. And that blame would be put on Hezbollah. Iran also has serious economic difficulties. They've got a new government. Much of their population do not want them to be involved in this type of this. And from the Israeli point of view, following up on what Simon said so eloquently, you know, the Israelis, many Israelis do not want a widening of the conflict. The Israeli military doesn't want to be fighting on two fronts. The Israeli intelligence services don't want this. And a lot of the Israeli population actually don't want fighting in Gaza as well as in Lebanon. The story that has been overshadowed by this overnight is mass protest in Israel, who are really calling for early elections and blaming Prime Minister Netanyahu for getting them into an open-ended war in Gaza. So I don't think anybody wants a direct confrontation, but I've got to be honest here. The risk is that as long as Israel is carrying out military operations in Gaza, as long as the hostages are still there, and there are still more than 100 who are either dead or alive being held by Hamas, that could always be the pretext for hardliners from Israel or from the other side to say, well, you know, we're tired of this. We're just going to go all out.
And look, it also keeps America embroiled in things if there's no tensions on the northern border there as well. So, Lorraine, some week for the Democrats, really, like it was
absolutely
for us far away here in Ireland, like it was like a week long circus. So, you pick Lorcan Nyan's piece in the Sunday Independent. Like JFK, Kamala gets it. Win hearts, not minds.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I did listen to her speech. She nailed her acceptance speech it said in this article, in spite of her lack of policy language, which is interesting because previous Democratic would-be presidents gave an awful lot of detail about what they were going to do, and she didn't. She came out as a fighter. This is what the article says, and I endorse this fully. She came out as middle class for the middle class, and I think that's what America wants to hear. She was supported by the brilliance of Michelle Obama, I think, which came very well for her as well. Middle class roots and her vision for the future was really what was impressive about her 35 minute long speech.
Okay. And Alison, did you enjoy the week?
Do you know what? I've been enjoying weeks and weeks of it. I have been obsessed with since Biden announced that he was stepping down and Kamala Harris came in. And somebody else came up with this phrase when I realised what I was doing. Rather than doom scrolling, it's hope scrolling. And it has added a bounce to my summer, I have to say. What worries me is that people like me, or even people who are far more qualified to comment in American politics, or even observers over there, that you don't get carried away with the hope. What is the reality? The reality is there is still a mountain to climb in terms of beating Trump. But I think that what happened in Chicago this week really set a very good scene for that. It's going to get much more tough now. It's going to get much dirtier. But I thought the Democrats really, brought the fight. I agree with what Lorraine said that, OK, there wasn't much policy, but I don't think that's where it was at. It was about her. So polls show that a lot of people don't know enough about her. Mm. So she told people about herself. And as Lorcan Lyon says in the Sunday Independent, that it brought that emotion, that sense of feel good, and that... Okay. It's a very good base to bring it on from there. Okay. So I think there's an awful lot to play for, but it's as good as it can be at the moment.
Scott, we'll keep it a little bit brief. To what Alison said there, and we did see Obama cautioning them, like no more than the Republicans were 4 weeks ago, whenever it was. They were a bit high on their own supply slightly, were they, like?
I think they know it's a toss-up election. And when we have another time, we can walk through the 7 swing states and exactly where they are. But they're in a toss-up election that they wouldn't have had 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
Because
okay.
Biden was going to hand the keys to the White House to Trump. Now, that campaign in the past 4 weeks has not put a foot wrong. And that convention, with the small exception of the Israel-Gaza issue, did not put a foot wrong this week.
You reckon? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let's go to a little bit of domestic politics before we go to the break. Alison, tell me about Bertie's secret meeting with Simon Harris.
Yeah, it's the front of the Mail on Sunday today. John Lee saying that Bertie paid a visit to his old office at the invitation of Simon Harris. And that it was likely to be seen as the latest step to rehabilitate Bertie's political character, and that there's speculation as to why did this happen, and that maybe that Simon Harris would, that everybody acknowledges that despite the controversy when he left office, that Bertie Ahern is somebody who's very good to speak to on the North. My first thought was, you're thinking, geez, where has Simon Harris found the time to be penciling in these sort of meetings?
He has time for everything.
I went along on Tuesday. Fine Gael had this, I think it was on Tuesday, event. It was as much to see him in the flesh, how he was looking. They had a parents and working families event, right? And you walked up the stairs and there was big balloons. And inside... there was a lot of children, which was lovely. It made for a lovely atmosphere. But down at the back, there was basically a mini sweet shop, right? And the kids were having a field day. And so the parents had some sugar high to deal with afterwards. And during the Taoiseach speech, you could hear them munching away. And I can say, reading the stuff today in all of the papers about the goodies that Simon Harris and Fine Gael are planning for us at the next budget, for the next election, it struck me, it's a continuation of that. It's basically... party bags for adults.
Okay.
It's bribing
us.
It's bribing us with our own sweets. We're all going to be munching and rotting our teeth if everything comes to pass. And all I can say is, if they don't have an early election, we are going to be bankrupt by March. If this is the level of promising that we're getting now, the whole thing is going to get out of control. So the Taoiseach is speaking in Béal na Bláth today. So all the papers have a sort of a line in the Business Post. Conal Thomas is saying it's removing the USC surcharge for the self-employed, reducing capital gains tax and reinstating a full defence minister. He's talking about the various options for the Fine Gael manifesto that's been sent around to members. But we know that looking at the inheritance tax threshold, we've also been looking at, we saw Peter Burke talk about a tax credit for under 25s, reduction in the USC, Simon Harris, in an interview with the Irish Times yesterday, was talking about the proceeds from the sale of the stake in AIB, which is around $2 billion, being used to speed up energy and water projects. So it is, I mean, budget bonanza is where they're going, setting expectations very, very high.
For the love of God, have an election and stop the promises.
I think we're entering kind of, I mean, I think the Greens were clever this week in what they said about this, about farmers and the in terms
the land tax.
Saying that it was like saying it was like withholding food in a famine. I think that was a clever political line. I think Jack Chambers could have done better, the finance minister, in informing his coalition partners what his plan was. But ultimately, this is the kind of thing we're going to be seeing now over and over as they each try. There's not that much difference, certainly, between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but they're going to be trying to outdo each other in differentiation.
Every man and woman for themselves now from here on in.
And all sucking a hard-boiled sweet.
Yeah. OK, we'll have to take a break. Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas, Simon Lewis and Lorraine Sweeney staying with me.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, Alison O'Connor, Scott Lucas, Simon Lewis and Lorraine Sweeney still with us. Everyone has picked a Nell McCafferty piece. Simon, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times by Orla and Niri. Nell was a genius and an outlaw. When she saw injustice, she'd act on it.
Yeah, I really liked reading all the piece about Nell McCafferty. I chose this one because there was a little mention of a story that I recently read in Fintan O'Toole's recent book, We Don't Know Ourselves, about the contraceptive train. And it was just a story. I liked the story because obviously it, you know, the message that was trying to be, I suppose, issued to the Irish government at the time about women's rights and about contraception and all the rest of it. But I suppose the bit that I really liked about the story was when they got to Belfast to get the contraceptive pill, they didn't realise, I don't know how true this is and someone will correct me on it if it isn't, that they couldn't get the pill, so they ended up having to get aspirin. But it was enough when they came back down to show that they had something.
Yeah.
And even that is the trailblazing of it and the cheekiness and the, I suppose, the chutzpah nearly as a word was really good. But I liked, you know, the light of the stories, but also the real seriousness and the fact that, and I suppose the phrase of speaking truth to power, and how she was able to do that so well. I know she had her critics, but maybe later in life and came off the media a little bit. But when she was speaking that truth and, you know, speaking to priests and saying, like, why should we be calling?
We should be teaching the Nell's works in school, should we?
I would love it. We're very conservative. I would love for us to be a more... I don't mean an angrier profession, but certainly more vocal. We already have that reputation, more vocal on social issues and, you know, asking those big questions of, you know, I mean, Nell McCafferty spoke about, you know, particularly about the role of the Catholic Church in society. We still have that in schools and the power they still have over jobs
many
things.
Yeah.
We need to ask those questions, and I think we could learn a lot. Certainly from her.
Lorraine, you picked Mary Kenny's piece, of course, was a great old mucker of Nell's.
Yes, Mary Kenny said her friend Nell was a fierce and funny advocate for change. Tremendous personality, brilliant journalist, pioneering feminist, a brave, audacious and fierce person. The interesting thing I thought about the whole thing about Nell was that she lacerated the Catholic Church, but yet she chose a Catholic funeral.
Yeah. She wouldn't be the first now. Like, it, I mean, they do a good send-off, I suppose. Scott, you picked Alison's writing about Nell in the Sunday Times. It's Nell showed us the power of compassion and the little things.
Yeah, I want to start off with a bit of a downer and then go upbeat with it. The thing about Alison's great piece is that it was right next to two letters from readers. And the headline on the letters from the readers were, "Feminists have sold women a fairy tale." And I think if Nell had seen that headline from those letters, she would have had a little bit of a laugh in terms of, well, we've come quite far, but there's always a bit more to be traveled on the road. The upside of it is, and again, as a blow-in and learning more about my new country, I was at the Irish Museum of Modern Art this week, and there's a great exhibit from the Dairy Film and TV Collective, you know, that existed in the 1980s. And part of it is a documentary that I couldn't see in the UK because it was banned in 1988, called Mother in Ireland. And it was about women's rights activists talking about these fights that they were fighting for in the 1970s, talking about all the challenges they face and they persist. So I had that experience of this incredible documentary versus learning about Nelma Cafferty. And others can speak more directly to her than that, but it was just a reminder to me that as Ireland is moving forward on women's rights, still has to go further, as my native country, the U.S., is moving backwards in many cases, that there's always the quest for light out of darkness. And Nelma Cafferty was one of those who always saw the light and always brought the light, not in a serious way at all times, but in an engaging way. And I think that's something that I cling to after my experiences of the past week.
Yeah, you need to be able to sell the story too, don't you? Mm. But Alison, that 50 years ago, and the fight still goes on, does it?
Yeah, I mean, when I was sitting down to write that piece, and thank you, Scott, for your kind words, your thought with Nell, where do you start? And I decided to focus in on the journalism. And now when I read her book on the having covered the Kerry Babies case, I read that book, A Woman to Blame, only a few years ago, and it is astounding. But then I read a piece that she wrote with McGill in 1983 about Raymond Gilmore, the IRA informer, and in court and his family being there. And it was a day in... It has stayed with me. I read it on Thursday, and I can honestly tell you it's one of the finest pieces of Irish journalism I have ever read. The light,
so what's
the
it called? Where would people find that?
If you Google, it was McGill 1983, and it's Raymond Gilmore, G-I-L-M-O-U-R, who was an IRA informant, and how they felt that having his family in the court might cause them to think twice. I mean, there are so many different, it's all about Nell being from Derry herself, the level of detail, and all those small details that she wrote so beautifully that meld together to reflect the bigger situation going on, the society, everything. But I mean,
she was an ideologue. But fundamentally, she was just clear-eyed, wasn't she?
She was. And then you read a lot as well about how a lot of those who were her allies and admired her then had a problem with her republicanism. And yet, how could she be, you know, have been different in many ways, given what she grew up in the midst of, and what Eamon McCann spoke so eloquently about at her funeral, about the night of Bloody Sunday and her reading out that report. There was a lovely quote that I lend on in that piece with Orlene Rehan by her niece Moira, where she said that Nell would always insist that, because she was so short, that she was 4 foot 11 and a half. And she said, "Our Nell was a tiny woman with tiny shoes, but they're shoes that no one will ever fill." And I think that summed it up beautifully.
Okay, thank you very much, Alison O'Connor. And thanks to the rest of my panel, Scott Lewis, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute, UCD, Simon Lewis, Principal of Carlow Educate Together National School and podcaster, and Lorraine Sweeney, businesswoman and hotelier. Scott Lucas. Okay, guys, that was excellent. Thank you very much.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.